And we are joined now by Vasily Nebenzia. He happens to be the Russian ambassador to the United Nations. And let me also say that he probably has one of the most difficult jobs in the entire world. And only he knows exactly what I'm talking about when I say that. Mr. Ambassador, thank you so much, sir, for taking time to talk to us.
Nice meeting you, Mr. Sanchez.
It's a pleasure to meet you, sir.
Although on the screen.
Yeah. Well, look, the UN is celebrating, 80 years now of its original chapter? And I'm thinking to myself as I watch the United Nations, and you're there, you're one of its most important players, many would argue the most important player these days. Has the United Nations met its mission? Is it accomplishing its mission?
June 26 is the day when the UN Charter has been signed exactly 80 years ago in San Francisco. In 2018, I made a UN pilgrimage to San Francisco and visited all those historical places. You know, it became kind of fashionable to criticize UN, and in many instances, rightly so. But, you know, UN doesn't have any magical international force. If we talk about UN as member states, not as a secretariat, which are 193, UN is the sum of those nations, all with their own national interests. The current situation in the UN reflects the state of international affairs, which is, of course, much to be desired. But at the same time, UN has still the legitimacy codified in its charter, in the Security Council decisions. The question is that people criticize UN that it cannot prevent or resolve crises that flare up around the world. But you know, UN doesn't have any magic pill. You cannot really have inflated expectations from multilateral diplomacy when the state of world affairs is such as it is.
Well,
you cannot eradicate human sins. So, I mean, quoting a classic, this is the art of possible.
Listen, I'll give you some examples of what's going on right now. You know it well. At least Colin Powell once went to the United Nations and he lied. Bibi Netanyahu showed a bomb and said this bomb's about to go off, and he was essentially lying as well. But at least they went and they lied. Today, countries are just doing whatever they want to do without even going to the United Nations, without even making a case before they act. That seems to most people to be bothersome. It must be bothersome to you as well.
Not all of them, but some of them definitely do. And many accuse Security Council that it cannot live up to its mandate. And some offer radical solutions like abolishing veto power or empowering the General Assembly. But again, let's take the Middle East crisis. The vote number is 14-1. And when they say the Security Council didn't fulfill its job, it's not the Security Council. It's one country that blocked the decision. The other thing is, and that's true, that
the
respect for the Security Council resolutions. Yes, the respect for the Security Council resolution dwindled. I can give you just one example. When in 1967, during the Six-Day War, the ceasefire was negotiated in the United Nations, mainly by between the Americans and the Soviets, of course, with the participation of Israel, Egypt, and Syria. The Israelis dragged trying to delay the ceasefire. Finally, the day of the ceasefire was set, and Israelis literally rushed to fulfill their military objectives before the ceasefire went into force, thus occupying the Golan Heights. That is to demonstrate that at that time Israel respected the decisions of the Security Council and was bothered with the reputation it will get if it doesn't fulfill them. These days it's not the case, and it's not the case only with Israel. I remember when the former U.S. ambassador to the UN, Linda Thomas Greenfield, after one of the resolutions adopted in the Security Council on the Middle East, on Palestine. On Israeli-Palestinian conflict, said to the press that this resolution is not mandatory to be implemented, while under Article 25 of the Charter it is.
Yeah, things have changed. You know what else has changed? I'm thinking now, and this interview that you and I are doing might be seen by hundreds of millions of people, so a lot of people will be interested in what you say about this change. It has to do with one person, Donald Trump. How is Donald Trump changing the geopolitical environment? Is it a net gain? Is it a net loss? How do you see it? How is it seen at the United Nations, Mr. Ambassador?
Well, if we talk United Nations and the change of the administration and the change in the U.S. policies, the multilateral institutions continue to function. The wheels are rolling. The gears are turning. They have their own dynamics. But of course, with the change of the administration from Democratic to Republican and vice versa, the position of U.S. on many issues changes 180%. Yes, Donald Trump is a special kind of politician. He likes paradoxical decisions. He likes quick fixes. He likes grandiose deals. And I think that he thinks also that UN is another swamp which needs to be drained. Yes, UN needs streamlining because there is a lot of duplication, non-coordination, non-core activities. But we have not to throw the baby with the bathtub water altogether. If I put it roughly, the position of the U.S. in the UN changes to more conservative with the Republican administration and to more liberal with the Democratic one.
Let's talk about Ukraine. It seems like the whole world, sir, is starting to realize that the gig is up for Mr. Zelensky. It looks like Donald Trump is realizing that, although further action is probably needed. The Polar South community certainly is recognizing it. Countries like Hungary have realized it. Slovakia has realized it. Unfortunately, for the Russian position, there are countries that are stalwarts, part of the old European system, like France and Germany and the UK, who have not realized it. And for some reason, they want this war to continue. Make the best argument that you possibly can for people who are listening to us for why you think the situation in Ukraine is what it is and how it should be settled.
There were some changes recently. Mm-hmm. We must recognize it happened thanks to the current U.S. administration. For the first time in 3 years, we had 2 rounds of direct talks in Istanbul, where important humanitarian decisions were adopted on the exchange of prisoners of war, on the exchange of dead servicemen, on other things. We exchanged memorandums how we see the end game of the conflict. But if you talk about the Europeans, they changed their rhetoric on the conflict from Russia. We should inflict strategic defeat on Russia.
Yes.
Then to Russia should not win in this war. Now they are advocating a full, immediate, and unconditional ceasefire. Which is a testimony that they want to shield and protect their proxy, because he's obviously losing on the battlefield. But this is rhetoric. But when it comes to the deeds, they continue to supply arms. They advise military advice on the ground. They provide satellite and other reconnaissance data. They are beating the drums of war, saying Russia is going to attack NATO imminently, and they have to rearm and spend more money on their military budgets. But, you know, we already passed through it during the Minsk agreements. When the Minsk agreements were adopted, everybody, we at least, believed that it will be the game changer and the deal break. But it turned out from day one that the Ukrainians and their sponsors sabotaged that agreement and demanded that Russia would be implementing it, although Russia was not even mentioned in those agreements. Then came the confessions of Angela Merkel, François Hollande, and Petro Poroshenko, who openly acknowledged that they were not going to implement that agreement in good faith, but it was needed only to buy time for Ukraine to rearm. So we are not going to get into this trap once again. We need to know what the end game is, what the outline of the final outcome would be, how genuine the Ukrainians are in willing to negotiate, what their position is. Their position at the moment is to roll back to where we were in 1991, which is not realistic. Then they have to demonstrate it by stopping the conscription, by demobilizing people, by that will be a litmus test on the seriousness of their demands and their position. But given their general non-negotiability, I think we should be realistic in realizing how serious that is.
Well, let's talk about some of the realism in Ukraine. And these are, you know, reports that have been confirmed inside and outside of Ukraine. And that is that they are taking people off the streets. We could show the video. I've seen the video. You've seen the video. People all over the world have seen the video. Unfortunately, these videos are not shown on CNN or on Fox News or on NBC, but they should be. Because we're looking at them now. These are people literally being ripped off the streets, thrown into cars, and taken to the front lines. We've confirmed reports that journalists have been arrested. One, an American journalist, was actually killed. That priests have been taken to jail. That political opposition has been imprisoned. These are realities of things that are taking place inside Ukraine. I'm not saying that because those things are taking place, the war needs to be decided one way or another, but these are things the world should know about, and many in the world do not know about these things. It has to be very frustrating for you. I imagine there's people at the UN who know about these. Maybe they talk about it in the corridors, though, right? Maybe not in public.
Of course, I've seen these videos, and of course, we talk about it at the meetings on Ukraine in the Security Council. But, you know, they are not listening, those who have to listen to it. I mean, our Western partners, they won't listen. They prefer to use Ukraine as a proxy in the game against Russia that they are undertaking. They are not sorry for the poor Ukrainians who are sent to the front as cannon fodder. They were not hesitant to prevent the deal that was nearly reached in Istanbul in 2022, in April, and initialed already by both sides. When Boris Johnson rushed to Kyiv to tell Zelensky to continue and win on the battlefield, which cost Ukraine hundreds of thousands of Ukrainians, which is awful, of course. So they are not humanists. I mean, the Europeans in that sense, they do not care about Ukraine. And this is not the war between Russia and Ukraine. Ukraine is a proxy in this war. This is a centuries-old war of the West against Russia, starting with the Polish invasion in the 17th century, then Napoleon 1812, then Crimean War, then the joint American UK German intervention during the time of the revolution, let alone the Nazi invasion during the Second World War. And by the way, it was not just the Germans who fought the Russians, it was the whole Europe. There were French, Dutch, Finnish, Romanian, Italian, Hungarian battalions, divisions in the Hitler army. The Ukrainian nationalist collaborators served in the Nazi SS divisions, etc. This should be seen in a larger context, I would say, not just in the conflict between Russia and Ukraine. What regards the conflict between Russia and Ukraine,
it's interesting. I was looking at some statistics. I did a little research before this interview with you, and I went back to look. Prior to this war, they asked Ukrainians, do you want to join NATO? Only 22% of people in Ukraine back before this, 66% wanted to remain on friendly terms with Russia. So it makes me think that something was cast or forced upon them that they didn't want.
Yes, it was.
Do you feel sorry for the Ukrainian people?
I'm sorry for the Ukrainian people. I also have roots there too. It's all mixed with Russia and Ukraine. And when Putin says that we are one people, he's not far from the truth. And in fact, he's right. And I think the same. I mean, of course, there are local folklore and other temperament, whatever differences. But I mean, these differences exist within Russia, within the regions, as much as with Ukraine. But that's not the case. The case is that Ukrainians are our brothers, no doubt about it. But the clique that came to rule them is indeed, this is a regime. This is not a government. Zelensky came to power on a promise to end the war in Donbass, which they started against their own population, against Ukrainians, with their army, which is forbidden in their constitution. He promised one thing, but he turned 180 degrees after it, he changed everything that he promised to the Ukrainian people, and he's not very much popular in Ukraine these days, if I may put it mildly. Besides, he's an expired president.
I have read that, expired, you're right, because his term expired and he decided not to have elections, something that, interestingly, as an American, is really important to me, because even Abraham Lincoln, during the Civil War, at the height of the worst time, with people killing everywhere, blood everywhere, and he decided, no, we still have to have elections. And he almost lost, but he still had elections. So if the excuse is we can't have an election because there's a war, well, then that's not a good one based on history anyway.
Look, the thing is that...
Let me ask you, though, about...
Can I just say one thing?
Go ahead.
Following up what you said.
Of course. Of course.
Politically, Zelensky is already dead. But personally, physically, I mean, the end of his presidency may entail something for him, which he's trying to avoid at all costs. That is reporting on the money stolen and the wrath of the people whom he failed miserably. So he has all the reasons why to cling to power and not to hold elections.
What do you mean by what you just said? What do you mean by what you just said about the money he has stolen?
Well,
can you explain that? I've always tried to understand how he's stealing. Is he just taking the money that NATO and the United States have given him in the past?
That's an open secret. They stole billions of dollars out of the aid they were receiving, and he was asked about it not just in Ukraine but by their sponsors as well. Even during the Biden administration, there were attempts to get him to account, to report on the money that he was provided with. And I think that when finally it comes to it, it will come to it. The revelations will be very dire.
I want to ask you about the EU and NATO, mm-hmm. organizations of people who are not elected and are very, very aggressive. And yet they seem to have an awful lot of power. They conducted coups in different parts of the world. They often pay media organizations and form media organizations in different places. They conduct regime changes. They have been aggressive. They bombed Belgrade. They bombed Iraq. They've tried to enter into Georgia. By the way, that has nothing to do with the North Atlantic. How can the North Atlantic Treaty Organization be involved in Georgia, which is, last time I checked on a map, very far away? So I'm puzzled by the EU and by NATO and by its role. And a lot of people are starting to ask why they do the things they do. For example, what they're doing in Ukraine. The Ukrainian people said, we don't want to be a part of NATO. And NATO seems to be saying, no, you will be a part of NATO, whether you like it or not. That sounds crazy.
You know, at the Madrid summit of NATO, a couple of years ago, they made a decision that that NATO has a global responsibility now. So Georgia is within reach, Far East within reach. You take any part of the globe, it's all NATO responsibility now. They say they're a defensive alliance. They stand for democracy, which can be challenged. And you just said it in your introduction, exactly why. They are not a defensive military alliance. They are an aggressive military bloc. that, you know, promotes expansion, promotes dominance. That was one of the reasons why the whole thing happened, because they were moving towards our borders despite the promises and commitments and pledges that they gave before the Soviet Union collapsed. And so it's nothing to comment. It has been commented so many times. It's all clear with that. What regards EU, you said non-elected officials. Yes, they rule. The ball there, despite not being elected, and they glue those members, their members together. And in fact, you know what? The European diplomacy here in the UN looks really very miserable. And I think that reflects some kind of political, moral, and even civilizational crisis of the West. You know, they are engaged in only one narrative, building their identity against one enemy, which is, of course, Russia, who is responsible for all the ills that happen in the world. They are busy with their neoliberal, promoting their neoliberal agenda in the UN, wherever it belongs and wherever it doesn't. The other thing is that they have this bloc discipline, and not very rare and very few countries can raise their voice to defend their own national interests, but most of the time they read the same script from the script that was prepared for them in Brussels. So it's all very, very sad, of course. But you know, the question is the crisis of the European politics in general. Look, who is ruling Europe today? Let alone Churchill and Roosevelt. Where is de Gaulle? Where is Chirac? Where is Mitterrand? Where is Kohl? These people were giants in their own sense, but these are some kind of dwarfs. I'm sorry to say it. I'm not naming any one of them. But regarding the names, and for example, I do not know by heart the names of most of the European foreign ministers, because they come and go like in kaleidoscope, and they leave no mark of their presence in the position. So this is a crisis of European politics altogether.
I won't say their names either, but I'll just say their initials are Starmer, Macron, and Merz. And we'll leave it at that.
You know, recently Merz made a...
Thank you, Mr. Ambassador.
Merz made a statement saying that Israel in Iran is doing a dirty work for us. And this is a country, a member of the JCPOA. Can you imagine that?
Yeah, I heard Starmer recently also was asked by a reporter if it was going to cost his people a lot if they end up engaging in a war with Iran. And he said, well, you know, the British people had to pay a lot during the situation in Ukraine, and they're probably going to have to pay again. And, you know, tough luck. It's like, those are your people, sir. You're supposed to be thinking of them, not Ukraine.
At the Sunday Security Council emergency meeting on Iran, the UK ambassador there said that she calls Iran to demonstrate restraint. Can you imagine the irony and the absurdity? I mean, Iran was a subject of unprovoked attack, and he's being called to demonstrate restraint.
It's a funny world we're living in, sir, and you are handling it right there. You're on center stage, as Shakespeare would say. Mr. Ambassador, thank you, sir, for taking time to talk to us.
Thank you very much, Mr. Sanchez.
You're a smart man, and I really enjoyed the back and forth.
Thank you.
Thank you, sir. Thank you. We appreciate
Bye.
It.